We started last week in Joshua chapter 4, verse 19, and we're going to start today in Joshua chapter 6, verse 12. What we saw in this in the preceding lesson was the people came up out of the Jordan in their crossing on dry ground. They camped at Gilgal, just east of Jericho. And Joshua erected a stone monument as directed by Yahweh there. And it was specifically talked about that as the children ask, you can talk about how Yahweh dried up the ground and we crossed the Jordan just like the Red Sea crossing in the previous generation. But that didn't stop there. It was also so that all the peoples of earth will know the hand of Yahweh is mighty and they will fear Yahweh forever. And the result was fear. In chapter 5, we see the kings were afraid. They'd heard of the Jordan crossing, and so it said that they were without any confidence at all and very much concerned for their future. And Yahweh commands Joshua, circumcise the men. So here they are camped right next to the city of Jericho, and the men are going to be circumcised. It was not done during the wandering for the 40 years, so they were catching up with the sign of the covenant that God had created, with Abraham. And so they did that. It was completed, and they healed. And God says, the reproach of Egypt has lifted from you. And so they named it Gilgal, which means a wheel rolling. So they're back in motion. They're back involved with carrying out the promise of obtaining the promised land through the power of God as promised to Yahweh. And so the next thing that happens is they observe the Passover on the 14th day of the first month, just as had been commanded as they came out of Egypt in the Exodus when the Passover was instituted. So they'd come up out of the Jordan on the 10th of the month, and so now it's 4 days later and they're doing their Passover. And it was also at that time that the people ate the produce of the land for the first time, and so manna stopped. And Joshua, toward the end of the chapter, is there near Jericho, and it says he sees a man with a sword in his hand. And Joshua goes out to ask him, are you for us or are you against us? And the answer is no, which is kind of an interesting answer. You gave me two choices. I'm rejecting them both. But he identified himself as a captain of the host of the Lord. And Joshua fell on his face and washed him, and worshiped him. And the Lord there, this time it's not Yahweh, it is Adonai. But he says to this person there, what has Adonai to say to his servant? And Adonai could be used as simply Lord, but it also often means God if it's in the emphatic form, and it is here in the emphatic form. So Joshua is clearly saying, God, what do you have for me? What do you want to say to me? And the only thing that is said is, remove your sandals. This is holy ground. Reminds you of the encounter with Moses at the burning bush. And it is a Christophany then, a presence of Christ here in the Old Testament. And then in chapter 6, we turn our attention to Jericho again, and Jericho is shut up. It's closed up, it's tight, they've got their gates closed, they're ready for something to come out of these nomad Jews there. And Yahweh says to Joshua, see, I have given you Jericho. And he starts giving instructions. And the instructions are, you're going to march around the city, all the men, once each day for 6 days. And there will be seven priests going with seven trumpets of ram's horns. And the Ark of the Covenant will be in the middle of this procession. And then on the seventh day, you'll go around seven times. And then they'll blow the trumpets. And the people will all shout. And at that time, the walls are going to fall down and you can go straight into the city. And so that shout is to be a shout of victory, for the Lord has given you the city. Now, the instructions also include that the city is under a ban, and the ban is that everything belongs to the Lord. And so everything is going to be destroyed except for some items that are set apart for Yahweh himself. And the exception is Rahab the harlot and all in her house are to be allowed to live. But it says, keep for yourselves no items from the ban. Don't covet them. Don't take any. To do so will bring a curse on Israel. And so these instructions are given. And that the things that are banned are generally gold and silver and a few other items. So these are the instructions that are given out for the taking of Jericho. So let's go down to Joshua chapter 6. And I'm going to read verses 12 through 27. Now Joshua rose early in the morning, and the priests took up the ark of the Lord. The seven priests carrying the seven trumpets of ram's horns before the ark of the Lord went on continually and blew the trumpets, and the armed men went before them, and the rear guard came up after the ark of the Lord while they continued to blow the trumpets. Thus, the second day they were marched around the city once and returned to the camp, and they did so for 6 days. Then on the seventh day they rose early at the dawning of the day and marched around the city in the same manner 7 times. Only on that day they marched around the city 7 times. At the 7th time, when the priests blew the trumpets, Joshua said to the people, "Shout, for the Lord has given you the city." This is a victory shout. "The city shall be under the ban, and all that is in it belongs to the Lord. Only Rahab the harlot and all who are with her in the house shall live, because she hid the messengers whom we sent. But as for you, only keep for yourselves from things under the ban." Keep yourselves from the things under the ban, so that you do not covet them, and do not take some of the things under the ban, and make the camp of Israel accursed and bring trouble on it. But all the silver and gold and articles of bronze and iron are holy to the Lord. They shall go into the treasury of the Lord. So the people shouted, and the priests blew the trumpets. And when the people heard the sound of the trumpet, the people shouted with a great shout, and the wall fell down flat. So the people went up into the city, every man straight ahead, and they took the city. They utterly destroyed everything in the city, both man and woman, young and old, ox and sheep and donkey, with the edge of the sword. Joshua said to the two men who had spied out the land, "Go into the harlot's house and bring the woman and all she has out of there, as you have sworn to her." So the young men, who were spies, went in and brought out Rahab and her father and her mother and her brothers and all that she had. They also brought out all of her relatives and placed them outside the camp of Israel. They burned the city with fire and all that was in it. Only the silver and gold and articles of bronze and iron they put into the treasury of the house of the Lord. However, Rahab the harlot and her father's household and all she had, Joshua spared. And she has lived in the midst of Israel to this day, for she hid the messengers whom Joshua sent to spy out Jericho. Then Joshua made them take an oath at that time, saying, "Cursed before the Lord is the man who rises up and builds his city Jericho. With the loss of his firstborn shall he lay its foundation, and with the loss of his youngest son he shall set up its gates." So the Lord was with Joshua, and his fame was in all the land. And so here we see them carrying out the instructions that God gave them. They start out early in the day, and they go around one time, and then again, and they keep repeating that first day's activities until they had completed 7 days. And then on the 7th day, they get up at dawn, very early start, and they go around 7 times. Now, the priests are blowing the trumpets, but there's a loud blowing that's going to occur when they've completed that 7th round. And so when they complete it, the priests blew their trumpets, and Joshua says, "Shout, Yahweh has given you the city." This is their victory cry. This isn't a shout to bring the walls down entirely. It's certainly obedience to God. It's certainly doing what God told them to do. And God told them it's at that point the walls are going to fall down. But Joshua, by saying, "The Lord has given you the city," that turns it also into a great victory cry. And so there they were, and the walls fell down, and they went straight in. A good question that was brought to me is, well, what happened to the Sabbath here? We're going around 7 days completing this. One of those days had to be a Sabbath. And I didn't have a quick answer, so I went out and did a lot of research to find out I didn't learn anything. What I learned was, obviously, if you complete this over 7 days, you're going to have a Sabbath. I did find one guy who, interestingly enough, tried to take the fact that their calendars were based on moons to gain some other extra days so they could have 1 week without a Sabbath every so often. I don't think that works. Can't put that together in my head. But so obviously God has given them instructions to do this, and it's going to include some work on the Sabbath day. Now, if you remember, we said it wasn't that far around it. Honestly, they're not traveling more than they would be allowed to travel later on a Sabbath day. So it wasn't a long trip on the 6 days. The seventh day would have been a little bit more because they had to go around seven times. But clearly, on one of these days, it was a Sabbath day, and God obviously intended for them on that day. He gave them specific instructions, and so around they go. There are some, and the ones I read that talked about this, that would like to think that the seventh day around was on the actual seventh day of the week, making it a Sabbath day that the victory occurs. And I can't say that isn't the case. But they were very, even the ones that said that were quickly saying, well, I can't say I know that. I just think it would be fitting. So because I think it's fitting, I'm going to tell you that I think it would be fitting. Well, I don't necessarily think that myself, but that's the information I could find about that. And so Joshua reminds them, we're under a ban. Do not take the things that belong to Yahweh, which is basically the metal items, some we would consider precious metals today, the silver and the gold. Some were more practical, the bronze and the iron. But nonetheless, these metal items go into the treasury. Everything else has to be destroyed. And he makes it clear that he gives specific instructions. Keep yourselves away from the items on the ban. Don't covet them. Sin starts when you imagine the sin, right? Sin continues when you start saying, I want it. And then when you turn the I want it into action, now you've got the act of the sin. But the sin really started clear back at the coveting. And Joshua says, don't do that. If you take something, it's going to bring curses on Israel. So he makes it clear they know that the stakes are high. It's not just about you. This is about the whole community of Israel. He also says, now Rahab the harlot and those in her house are to live because she helped with the spies and protected the spies, and we've made a covenant with her. We're going to honor that. And so Joshua gives instructions to the spies who would know her to go and to get her and all of her family out. So all the silver, all the gold, all the bronze, all the iron is holy to the Lord, is a statement Joshua makes. That's more than just it belongs to God. It's holy to the Lord. It is consecrated for his purposes and his use. When Joshua met the man beside the city of Jericho holding the sword, and he goes to him and says, are you with us or with our enemies? What's the one instruction he's giving? Take off your shoes, you're on holy ground. Now, Joshua could have walked the same ground an hour earlier. As a matter of fact, he was out there. Was it holy then? No. Was it holy after the encounter with Joshua? No, or they'd have had to stake it out and say, hey, if you come in here, this is holy. No shoes, right? So when God consecrates a space or a thing, an object for his use and makes it holy, it's far more than just his possession. It's a part of his pure being and his intentions, and it's consecrated in a way that says this is not only holy, it has to be revered as holy. It's a part of worshiping God to take those things and keep them holy and for his purpose. So it would be a defilement of God himself to take these things. And so that was not to be done. And so they went into the city. It was utterly destroyed. All the living things were killed. And it was done as a part of their warrior action, both man and beast and all associated with them. And so they saved Rahab and her family. They took her out of her dwelling place. And then they took, where did they take them to? Where did they put them?
Outside of camp.
Why outside the camp?
Because they're not
part of any of those tribes, are they? And the people in the camp are there, they're ordered by their tribes, they're a part of the promise to Abraham, and they're the ones to receive the promised land. And so they're taken out there, and yet there are very good words said here, because Rahab and her family continued with the Israelites, and they said that Rahab was with them to this day, whenever the day was that this was being written. Another thing we're saying is, and they made note of the fact, that the silver, gold, bronze, and iron, those things were taken out and put into the treasury. And then Joshua, when all this is ending, he said he made them take an oath. So they get together and there's an oath made, and the oath that he leads them into is that anyone that rebuilds this city of Jericho will be cursed before Yahweh. The man that rises up and builds the city of Jericho will do so with the loss of his firstborn as he lays its foundation, and the loss of his youngest son, he shall set up its gates. And go with me over to 1 Kings 16:34. Now, in 1 Kings 16:34, we are in a time of the divided kingdoms. And we're in the northern kingdom in this case. And in the northern kingdom, we're at the time when Ahab was king. Not a good time in the eyes of God. But while Ahab is king, this is mentioned in verse 34 that it happened. Doesn't read the same in 2 Kings. Give me a minute. Let me go over to 1 Kings. I was like, what did I do this time? 1 Kings chapter 16, verse 34. In the days of Hiel, the Bethlehemite built In his days, Hiel the Bethlehemite built Jericho. He laid the foundation with the loss of Abiram, his firstborn, and set up its gates with the loss of his youngest son, Segub, according to the word of the Lord, which he spoke by Joshua, the son of Nun. People ought to read their scriptures. Here is a man that, if he knew of the curse, he didn't believe it. If he didn't know the curse, he would have been well advised to have learned it, because he paid dearly for an attempt to rebuild the city of Jericho. And when we read that verse, when we read in the book of Joshua, it sounds like Joshua initiated this curse. But really, who spoke it? According to the verse we just read in 1 Kings, Yahweh spoke the word through Joshua. And it's very clear that however you would want to try to understand the initiation of this curse, it was extremely prophetic. It was known to go by God this would happen, and he had Joshua pronounce this curse to show his might and his power. And so God demonstrates that by fulfilling that curse hundreds of years later. In verse 27, as we finish the chapter, we see that it says that Yahweh was with Joshua, and his fame filled all the land. So in the course of their crossing the Jordan, in the course of their conquest of the territories east of the Jordan, in the course of their conquest of Jericho, they are becoming known. And when we reach the conclusion of their conquest of Jericho, it says Yahweh was with Joshua, and we knew that, but his fame filled all the land. The more than just the Israelites were aware that there was a very powerful force in the land of Canaan, and they were there to take the land of Canaan. And they were greatly feared. And Joshua was recognized throughout their territory as the leader that was succeeding so far in doing so. So it was much more than just the Israelites. And of course, it's really the power of God that's in Joshua that people are seeing. Questions, comments, thoughts? You know, we ought not take lightly those words we read in the Scripture, should we? There are many things said in Scriptures that we might get the idea that they are mostly true, and I don't mean true and false. I mean the Scriptures tell us about how to live our lives and styles and actions of our living. And to not put our whole heart into living those words out has consequences. And so that's very much illustrated in the proclamation that Joshua made about what would happen. How can we give you a hand in some way? All right. Let's go on. If you don't have anything else on 6, let's go on to chapter 7. And I'm going to start with the first 15 verses. But the sons of Israel acted unfaithfully in regard to things under the ban. For Achan, the son of Carmi, the son of Zabdi, the son of Zerah, from the tribe of Judah, took some of the things under the ban. Therefore, the anger of the Lord burned against the sons of Israel. Now Joshua sent men from Jericho to Ai, which is near Beth Aven, east of Bethel, and said to them, "Go up and spy out the land." So the men went up and spied out Ai. They returned to Joshua and said to him, "Do not let all the people go up. Do not let all the people..." Said to him, "Do not let all the people go up. Only 2,000 or 3,000 men need to go up to Ai. Do not make all the people go up, for they are few." So about 3,000 men from the people went up there, but they fled from the men of Ai. The men of Ai struck down about 36 of their men and pursued them from the gate as far as Shebarim and struck them down on the descent. So the hearts of the people melted and became as water. Then Joshua tore his clothes and fell to the earth on his face before the Ark of the Covenant until evening. Both he and the elders of Israel, and they put dust on their heads. Joshua said, "Alas, O Lord God, why did you ever bring this people over the Jordan only to deliver us into the hand of the Amorites to destroy us? If only we had been willing to dwell beyond the Jordan. O Lord, what can I say since Israel has turned their back before their enemies? For the Canaanites and all the inhabitants of the land will hear of it, and they will surround us and cut off our name from the earth. And what will you do for your great name?" So the Lord said to Joshua, "Rise up. Why is it that you have fallen on your face? Israel has sinned, And they've also transgressed my covenant, which I commanded them. And they have even taken some of the things under the ban and have both stolen and deceived. Moreover, they have also put them among their own things. Therefore, the sons of Israel cannot stand before their enemies. They turn their backs before their enemies, for they have become accursed. I will not be with you anymore unless you destroy the things under the ban from your midst. Rise up, consecrate the people, and say, consecrate yourselves for tomorrow, for thus the Lord, the God of Israel, has said, there are things under the ban in your midst, O Israel. You cannot stand before your enemies until you have removed the things under the ban from your midst. In the morning, then you shall come near by your tribes. And it shall be the tribe which the Lord takes by lot shall come near by families, and the family which the Lord takes shall come near by households, and the household which the Lord takes shall come near man by man. It shall be that the one who has taken one who is taken with the things under the ban shall be burned with fire, he and all that belongs to him, because he has transgressed the covenant of the Lord, and because he has committed a disgraceful thing in Israel. So put yourself in the position of the Israelites after the time of Jericho. I mean, have they had anything go wrong? Was Jericho a major city? Yes. Was it fortified? Yes. Huge walls, double walls, houses built on the walls. They had some power. And so here come the Israelites, and they follow God's instruction. They march around the city. These magnificent fortified walls fall inward. They're able to walk right in and just take the city. What level of confidence would you be inclined to have as one of the people in Israel in that group at that time?
Invincible.
You know, we saw some Chiefs football teams a couple of years ago talking about a three-peat, right? They thought, yeah, well, the big talk was going to work and they'd make it. But that big talk would be nothing compared to this. I mean, this would be, and it should have been, a huge confidence builder that, wow, this is how it goes when you're following what God tells you to do in a conquest like this. And so now comes the time they're going to the next town. And that next town is Ai. And every time I give you a handout, the next time I want to do something, that handout didn't quite look right, so I do something else. But anyway, I gave you a handout this morning, and you can see on that Jericho is there and Gilgal are both close to the Jordan River. It's not a very great handout. I tried to find good ones that I could copy and use, but this turned out to be about as good as I could find. And now they're headed for Ai, which is up near Bethel somewhere. You see the question mark behind Ai because it's not very firmly identified just exactly where it is. But pretty much archaeologists have narrowed it down to a couple of places. They thought they had it a few years ago, quite a few years ago. But then they found another settlement. They went, no, this is really more like what Ai is described as. And they believe that's it. But it's in that general area. And so they're headed up to Ai. And so they're starting at Gilgal. And so the spies are sent up. But there's a problem. And verse 1 brings the problem right out in front of us. The sons of Israel have been unfaithful with respect to the ban. And we get told the story that Achan, who was in the tribe of Judah, took some things in the ban. Now, what do you suppose he was thinking? There's a couple things here that are almost necessary for him to think. Can you kind of ferret those out in your head? Let's ask a more specific question. What do you think he expected to be the benefits to him for taking the things in the ban?
Well,
got some wealth, might even have some prominence. I know there were kinds of things in my ancestors, my parents, more my dad, and then his parents, but they would see something and they would just keep it, because someday there aren't going to be very many of those around. This will be kind of unique. And so he may have thought, well, I'm going to have some things that will be interesting over time, because nobody else will have anything from the land of from Jericho. And so, but there's something that has to be kind of an assumption that either comes out of ignorance, lack of thought, or whatever, but somehow he's got to believe that taking these isn't going to have serious consequences. I mean, if he had thought about what was coming, he wouldn't have taken them. But no, he took them. And isn't that the way the deception of sin happens in our lives? Something tempts us and we think it will, in some way, bring something in our lives that we're going to be glad we have in our lives. Either an experience, or in this case, it's thievery, and he's got some goods that clearly he was told, don't do that. And Joshua had even given the consequences. Do you remember how Joshua said it? What did he say? You can go back and look at chapter 7 or 6 a bit. He was telling them, don't take the things, don't even covet them, because. What's the because? Well, you can't take them with you, but he gives a because.
Bring trouble upon the camp.
Yeah, it's going to bring a curse on the sons of Israel. This sin is not going to be isolated if you do it. There's even a bit of a sense of the people should have been on guard, watching each other a little bit, helping them get over their covetousness. You don't want to do that. Put that down. Or take it to the treasury, but don't take it to your tent. You're going to curse all of us. But Achan somehow either thinks God won't notice, won't see it, or God isn't going to do anything about it, or something. He thinks he's going to be able to hide it. But sin just doesn't work that way. And so we get a chance to see how it was brought out. And so Joshua sends spies up to Ai. And if you looked at that map, it's generally believed, even though we can't be exact because we don't know exactly where Ai was or its remnants are, I think it's about 12 and a half miles away. And it is a fortified city, but it wouldn't be fortified. Both of the locations were fortified. But it wouldn't be fortified like Jericho was, and it was a much smaller city than Jericho. I didn't get any good ratios in that or anything, but we will find out later. I thought I wrote that right here. In verse 3 here it says they were few. When we get over to chapter 8, it's going to say there were 12,000 of them. So the city's, you know, half the size of Emporia, I suppose. There were about 12,000 people there. But another interesting thing in that 12 and a half miles, height-wise, with relation to sea level, how high is the Dead Sea, do you know? It's below sea level. The town of Jericho, the Jericho site that's been excavated, itself was 700 feet below sea level. However, both of the sites of Ai are up in the hills. It even talks about being in hills in chapter 8, I believe. And they're 2,900 feet above sea level. So as they're going up, they're ascending about 3,600 feet in altitude in that 12 miles. That's a pretty good change. It's not like the Rocky Mountains, but that's a pretty good change. And so the spies go up and they come back, and what's their answer? What?
Piece of cake.
Piece of cake. That's the words that came to my mind. Piece of cake. We don't even need, we can do this with one hand tied behind our back. As a matter of fact, don't take both hands up there. How many people did the spies say to say? Take.
3,000.
Yep, and how many did they send?
3,000.
They sent 3,000. And so they said, there's not many people there. Now, how many soldiers did Israel have roughly available?
400,000.
Close, or closer than three. They had 600 and probably 60,000 men that in the various census that could have been available. Now, some time's gone by since the census, so maybe that changed a little bit. So, I mean, they're just sending out a little trickle of people compared to what they had available. And so up they went, and they're just going to just wipe over AI and be done and come home and say, okay, that's done, now where do we go? What happens to them? Yeah, they find themselves quickly put on the run. And so the people of AI were overcoming them easily. And it said they pursued to Shabarim, which probably are some quarries about a half mile away. Some translations translate that as a titling word, so it would be a place with that title. But Shabarim is real close to the word that would mean quarry. As a matter of fact, Shabarim as it is means fractures or breakers, broken ground. And so they believe there were some quarries down the hill, and it's a pretty steep hill leading down there, probably about a half mile away if it's the quarries they think they were. And so they pursued them about a half mile and chased them, and in that half mile they killed 36 of the Israelites, which from the sounds of things, they probably were lucky it was limited to 36. Lucky they didn't get them caught where they wiped out a lot more of them. So they have this pursuit, they go back home. What happens to the attitudes and the thoughts of the people when they get home? Absolutely devastated. What's the descriptive words about their hearts? Their hearts were like?
Melted.
Okay. Yeah. And here I am. Translation is different things, but like water, some of the translations say. And so here you are. That's how the people around them have been described. And now they are the ones being described that have no courage left. They're afraid. They're done. They don't know what to think. Joshua, his actions were he tore his clothes, he fell on his face before the ark of Yahweh until evening. And the elders were there with him, and they were putting dust on their heads. What do those actions signify?
Grieving.
What?
Grieving.
Grieving.
Humble.
What?
Humble.
Oh, humbled? Yeah, very much so. They were devastated. That tearing of the clothes, when you hear words that are disturbing, often they would tear their clothes. If a king heard of the lost battle, tear his clothes. Those kinds of things. It's signifying that he is beside himself, is how we might say it. He's upset. The dust on his head symbolizes great grieving and humbleness before God, and he's there with the elders as well. And so they're in great distress. And Joshua takes the distress to Yahweh. In this case, it says Adonai Yahweh. And it's translated often Lord God. But he says, why did you bring this people over the Jordan only to deliver us to the Ammonites, to destroy us? If we had been willing to live, only if we had been willing to live beyond the Jordan. So what's the substance of that question to God? What's he saying?
Why have you left us, God?
Well, why have you left us? But really, he's backing up a few steps. Why'd you even bring us here? Kind of sounds like some previous generations, doesn't it? And he also says, if only we'd been willing to live on the other side of the Jordan. What's wrong with that question? The question itself is full of indictment of Joshua. What's the indictment of Joshua held in that question? Can you see it?
Didn't trust God.
Well, didn't trust God?
He was trying to tell him how it should have been.
Did he try to tell him how it should have been? Who brought them across the Jordan? Who told him to go? Did the people say, God will accept nothing less than crossing the Jordan? Is that the way they went at this?
No.
So who told him to go across the Jordan? And why did the Lord tell him to go across the Jordan? Promised land. And what's the promise? It's a covenant with Abraham. Joshua is saying, if only you hadn't made a covenant with Abraham. If only you hadn't told us to go across the Jordan. But no, he puts it like they were in charge. If only we'd have been content to stay over there. How foolish we were to try to come across the Jordan and take this land. I mean, it's a lack of faith. It's a lack of understanding of who led them into this. Are there some questions that Joshua needs to be asking God right now?
How did we sin?
Yeah, where did we go wrong? What did we do that offended you? Why have you obviously withdrawn from supporting us through this conquest of this land? But that isn't what he says. He's really accusatory of God. And there's even one thing, the way the New American Standard translates it, that I think is valuable. Why did you bring this people over the Jordan? What are this people normally called? What?
Your people.
Who do these people belong to? Joshua is taking ownership of the people. Now, I don't think he's supplanting himself in the place of God, but he's looking at all that and saying, oh boy, did we make a dumb decision. Wasn't your decision, you didn't make it. You better be finding out why the one that did make the decision has now withdrawn from seeing that your conquests are going the way that you expect them to go based on his promises and what he's done so far. And so I think really this is a real crucial time for Joshua and the people of Israel to recognize God again. When things don't go right, the first thing they do is take God off the throne to an extent.
I was just thinking, kind of, I think it's an extremely prideful response. In Desiring God, John Piper says that self-pity is the response of pride to suffering.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they just had this huge victory, and this was supposed to be an easy thing, and it's all about how God did wrong to Joshua, not self-introspection, like we must have mixed something up here. No, it's all, why did you do this, God? It's just mm-hmm. an extremely prideful response.
Well, they also had a huge clue, and they made a huge error earlier. How did they decide how many men were headed up to Ai?
Spies.
They sent spies up. And spies came back and said, 2,000-3,000 be good. There aren't very many of them. Whose strength are the spies planning on to take Ai?
Theirs.
They're not planning on God's. Oh, yeah. Who gave all the instructions about how we're going to do Jericho? Who gave all the instructions about how we're going to do AI? There should have been, whoa, hold on. Joshua should have said, we need to inquire from the Lord how he wants us to do this. If you gave military planners in this era, if you could somehow transpose the way we think about the military now back then, and there probably were people just like this, and you said, look, you got this many men, you got this much stuff, tell me how you're going to do this attack on Jericho. Is there a chance in the world that they would have said, well, the first thing you need to do is pray, and the second thing you need to do is don't do anything until you get God giving you very clear, direct answers? And would they be excited about the plan of marching around it once a day for 6 days, and then the seventh day going around seven times, and then blowing the trumpets. Is it very likely those military planners would have said, this is a good battle plan. This'll work. And yet, that's what the people experienced. Now, if you experience that when you get ready for the next battle, where do you want to start? Well, let's go up there and just see if we got better swords than they do. Huh? Are you kidding me? And so this is a part of their training, along with dealing with some sin in the camp. Because the silence of God should have been deafening. God told us how to cross the Jordan. God told us where to camp. God told us what to do in the camp. They had the Passover, which maybe they could have come up with on their own looking at the calendar, but they also circumcised the men. They renewed the covenant. And then God says, okay, here's how you're going to do it. And by the way, be quiet until the time at the end when the trumpets all blow loudly, then you're going to shout. And God even told them what their path was going to be into the city. And now we're getting ready to go to Ai, and you've got none of that information. Wow, that's quite a change. And it didn't even come to their thinking in such a way it got mentioned in the scriptures. That now we're going to do it on our own, now that we got past Jericho. That's not going to work for them, particularly with the sin in the camp. What's Joshua's big concern? How does he reply to God when he, after, in question 8, he says, Israel turned their backs to the enemies. Essentially, we were routed. What does he tell God about his expectation now? No, not really. I mean, not really. Look at verse 9. What does he tell God he now expects?
Defeat.
The Canaanites, everyone's going to hear about this.
Cut off our name.
And they will cut off our name from the earth. In other words, they're going to wipe us out and we'll be forgotten. We won't even be a footnote in history, hardly. What does that tell you about where Joshua is at this moment? He's looking at worldly cause and effect. And you don't see him complaining about being widely known and popular when they defeated the people at Jericho. But now he's saying, we're going to be widely known. They're going to know that this little runt town of Ai just sent us running into the woods. They're going to hear that. No, we can be beaten. And they're not going to wait around to find out what we do next. They're going to come down. They're going to surround us. And they're going to kill us all. That's essentially what Joshua says. And then Joshua asks maybe the first question that starts to make some sense in front of God. And what will you do for your great name? That's the only right question in this whole exchange. Why is that a good question?
Because it's being concerned about the glory of the Lord rather than
it's about the glory of the Lord. Everything they've done so far, putting the stones up. Why do we put the stones up? So that everybody will know that the Israelites are great? That they somehow could dam up the water? No. So that the world will know and your own children will know Yahweh dried up the water and we crossed the Jordan on dry ground. And that Yahweh is great. It wasn't about you guys. It was about Yahweh. It was about God. And now he needs to be coming back saying, I don't know what happened, God. I'm confused. How do you want to glorify yourself through the Israelite nation next? What's next in the plan? And it's right when God's glory is primary. It goes back to the purpose of the stone memorial. Well, it goes back to the name of Gilgal and that memorial was right in that camp. And so now God speaks to Joshua in verse 10. And what does he say? Get up. Why are you on your face? Here's the problem. It isn't that I did something or didn't do something. He doesn't say that. But when he states the problem, it becomes clear this is not a failure or some letdown of God toward them. It is Israel has sinned. Israel has violated my covenant. They've taken things that were under the ban. They have stolen. They have deceived. More significantly, they placed these things among their personal possessions. Why is that more significant? They're saying God's stuff can be my stuff. It's as good for me. I don't know if good in the sense of moral and evil, but it's as appropriate for me to have him as God. Yes, sir.
It's a lot different when you have Jewish roommates and they invite you to a brisk.
Yep.
Brisk is the procedure of circumcision. It has to be done with a silver knife. The foreskin has to be put away properly. My point, and there's a lot of other regulations among the brisk, but my point being is they are extremely litigious.
Hmm?
Extremely litigious.
Yeah, and they should have been extremely obedient here. God gave them very specific instructions through Joshua, and they should have followed them. And so God said, that's why your enemies defeated you in battle. You went up without me. And I was not going to let you win. You departed from me. You people are accursed, God says. And I will not be with you until the banned items are destroyed. And so he gives them instructions. Get up, consecrate the people for tomorrow. Tell them that banned items are in our camp. And we're not going to have any victories until these banned items are removed. In the morning, God says, come near to the tribes. The Lord shall reveal through lots the offending party, starting with the tribe, and then the family, and then the household, and then man by man. So they're going to keep narrowing it down. And the offending party will be burned by fire along with all of his possessions. It's going to be a day, a very sobering day. Because why is he going to be burned? He has violated the covenant of Yahweh. And he's committed a great disgraceful thing in Israel. This is totally unacceptable. Now, how did they say that they were going to determine who the offending parties were? They were going to do it
by lots.
What's that?
Kind of like dice in a
way. What's that? Somebody else said something.
That's why I threw in dice.
It is. What?
Something that priest had, didn't it?
Well, it was a part of the priest's attire, and probably is the priest is going to come with the lots. They don't say that specifically, but they were the ones that had it. It was on their attire. The high priest had it in as a part of his robe. He had a place to keep them. And to say we know truly exactly what they are, we don't. The most common description is it's kind of like rolling dice, but if we actually did use dice and it came up six, I don't know what that would mean. So there was something about doing it that identified God's response. What made these work was not that they were lots. What made these work was the power of God himself to ensure that what he wanted to communicate came up through the lots. And so lots were used in many things. What's one of the famous places that lots were used?
Christ's clothes.
They cast lots because he had that woven tunic that was of one piece, and it was woven in one piece, and they didn't want to tear it up in order to share it among themselves. So they cast lots for it. So it would become used as kind of a gambling tool to some extent. Folks that I've looked for lots before. I knew I wasn't going to find a clear, definitive answer. But one of the guys said this. He said, well, it effectively was like flipping a coin. It's either going to come up yes or no. And for each of these groups, as they come around, it's going to be a yes or a no in some fashion that God is controlling this so that they identify the right people. And we're not going to have time for it today, but we'll get a chance to watch that run its course next time and talk about what happens to Achan and his family and how that extends out into the people. Comments for today? All right, well, thank you for your patience with my challenge, and we'll see you next time.